So I think we're, just to kind of recap something that Bruce said yesterday about the situation we're in right now, right, where you've got something brewing in the Middle East, a major crisis there, right, you've got the spread of this avian flu. In Germany, I think there was a report of having infected a cat. You know, it's killed half the people that it's infected. Right, and this is it's only a matter of time before it reaches Canada and the United States. At the same time, you have an insane administration in the States. You have a hardcore right-wing religious fundamentalist government in Canada that could ally itself with a separatist party to form a majority to potentially dismantle the country to some extent. Through increased decentralization, things of this nature, where the, you know, you have a separatist, a Western Canadian separatist movement that could unite with a Quebec separatist movement and run the country into the ground. Okay. So you have this. At the same time, as I speak and as we sit here, there is the possibility that the Central Bank of Japan is considering raising interest rates, which would bring to an end this kind of free money situation we've had for the past 10 years, in which it basically kept the United States economy out of complete bankruptcy, as well as the world financial system. So we're kind of at a point in time where we need to consider who we are as Canadians, what it means to be Canadian, and take stock of our situation, right? And we do have a much different country than the United States, although the relationship, and what I'm going to go through a little bit today, deals with this question of the dynamic relationship between Canada and the U.S., and how I think as we look at this and as we look into it further, that really Britain had never done anything for this country that had any kind of positive or enduring value. Right? Anything good that's happened in Canada is because of Canadian and American cooperation and collaboration over the years. So I think I'd like to start with maybe posing a question in a few, this question of what it means to be Canadian. I don't know if people have any ideas or thoughts they want to contribute on that, like what, or if you're new to the country or something like that, what your impression is of, is there a Canadian identity? Anybody have any thoughts on that? We're not looking for a definition necessarily, but any...
I think in Canada, to be Canadian, you need a Canada, a country.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it ever exists.
Yeah, it's kind of a debatable question. I was reading this interesting speech by this fellow, Peter C. Newman, who's a fairly prominent Canadian writer and journalist. And he had a few interesting things to say about this question. And the speech he gave was actually called The Importance of Failure in the Canadian Psyche.
The importance of failure
in the Canadian psyche, and I have a copy, and I heard like the people here should take a look at this. I mean, it's very funny, and I think insightful. He has some problems there in understanding the U.S. But I want to read a few parts of this. It's not too long, but I think it'll give a sense of, you know, maybe what the problem is. So he says, failure to the Canadian psyche is what yeast is to bread making. Right? We thrive on making the worst of bad situations and on underestimating our collective and individual worth at every turn. Right? There was somebody who said that, who complained or lamented about the complexities of being American. And he said, well, being a Canadian is easy. Deference is our state religion. Prostration, our national posture. Right. And he also says the first law of being Canadian decrees that we denigrate everything, every good thing we do, take a negative stance toward every Canadian achievement, nitpick to death anything positive, starve anyone with talent, and drive out anyone who dares show cultural or artistic leadership or excellence. Right, and we know this is the case. We talk about the brain drain or all this kind of stuff, or, you know, we won't accept somebody as being competent in the arts or anything unless they've gone to the United States or Europe and made a name for themselves first. Right, if it's like a homegrown talent, we're going to pretend we don't even know who those people are, generally. Quebec's a little bit different, but it is a... Now he says, we have dribbled away our self-esteem and patrimony in revolutions we did not launch and acts of daring we managed to avoid. Right. Now, something that's interesting, we have a map back here of Canada, right? And does anybody know where the geographic center of Canada is?
Geographic.
The geographic center of Canada.
Yellowknife?
No, it's a place called Baker's Lake.
Well, and it's in by geographic center?
Well, I mean, like, if you look at Canada, right, what is the... That map won't have it, but that one will. And that's close to the context. Okay, yeah, that could work. Yeah, it's basically a place in Nunavut. I mean, the actual center of the nation geographically. It's Syria, Canada, Baker Lake, it's up here. There's Baker Lake. So that's the center of Canada. we're there.
Sorry.
Okay. Now, what does this mean?
Yeah.
Right. So he says we need 7 separate time zones to accommodate the prodigious dimensions of the Canadian subcontinent. Right? Canada extends through 88 degrees of latitude, and I think 88 degrees of longitude and 48 degrees of latitude. Right. Our country covers 1/14 of the Earth's land surface and is larger than China, with a population smaller than Ethiopia's. Right. And 3 out of 4 Canadians live in a chili-shaped strip, 160 kilometers from the U.S. border. And only 7% of our country has been settled. 7%.
Has been what?
Settled. Right, there's people only live on about 7% of the territory of Canada. Now, he also makes this interesting comment that Canada is perhaps the worst designed country in history. Right? Like, yes, what country is 4,000 miles long and 200 miles wide? You know, because if you actually look at the way we're designed, right, where do people live? They live here. Right. The majority is 4,000 miles long and about 200 miles wide. So geography certainly has something to do with kind of being dwarfed by our surroundings. Maybe it's, you know, some people think maybe it's the winters. Right? The cold just creates this depressing culture or something like that. You know, but many other countries have this too. Russia, right? I mean, Russia is in some ways colder, you know, or as cold as Canada. But they seem to have a sense of being a nation. Now, he kind of goes through this stuff, and he also makes this question about the Aboriginals, right? The Indians, and a fellow from the Canadian Air Force made a very insightful comment. He said that Native Canadians, you could really think of them as displaced people with seniority. So I just screwed that up. Displaced people with seniority, right?
Okay.
So we're all displaced people, in a sense. And he makes this comment that maybe the problem is that Canada was born without being conceived. Now that's an interesting way of looking at it.
Just like Jesus.
God bless Canada.
Yeah, I don't know. That could be a tough one to make.
Parallel.
Tough parallel. But I think as we look at the history, this period of history leading up to Confederation, that this is certainly something to take into consideration. Right, that we were created. Yeah, we came from somewhere. We do seem to be a country with laws and things like that, but compare where Canada came from with the United States, as Bruce talked about yesterday. Right, compare that history and that tradition, and you have something very different. And Canadians do seem to have an inferiority complex in general, and certain problems of potency and acting. And it brings up this question of citizenship versus subjects. Right? Are we citizens or subjects? And perhaps the way that we came about as a nation, or a supposed nation, has something to do with the way today that we think of ourselves and our ability either to affect government, to participate in politics, to shape our nation. Now, this then leads to the question of patriotism. Now, when you think about Canada, do you ever associate an idea of being Canadian with patriotism? Do you ever hear people talk about patriotism? Yeah?
Well, Moulton's working on that.
Moulton?
Yeah.
With these I Am Canadian ads?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Look at these ads. I am Canadian. And what they say is basically,
I'm not American.
So what kind of country defines itself negatively by what it's not? You know, what country basically allows other nations to define it? Right? I mean, this mm-hmm.
Because it's Christian patriotism, it's mm-hmm. true that you hear it a lot in sports. The Olympics, you know, or when you kick some other nation's ass,
mm-hmm.
it's usually when you hear about
mm-hmm.
your patriotism.
Yeah, kind of a, when you think about it, it's kind of, yeah?
Sure. Oh, well, I'll let you finish that.
Yeah, I mean, you think about that kind of patriotism, right? It's like a, I mean, it's just a, it's kind of a degenerate form almost, huh? Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, think about, like, the army, the great army story that we have is not about fighting for our rights. It's about, well, we helped in this war, and we helped in this war, but we never really did something for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What's the big interest in patriotism, anyway? Because it can be dangerous, too. It can be stupid.
Yeah, well...
And you also get, segregation, separation, chauvinism.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I think one of the interests of Canada is that we're also very mellow, moderate, and open, and a lot of people feel citizens of the world, you know, and stuff like that. I think that's interesting too.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's all important stuff. But I mean, this idea of patriotism, I mean, really it's a question of love of your nation, right? And yeah, you can have. Maybe we should make a distinction between patriotism and nationalism, right? Like, because a lot of people talk about, you know, the Nazis, like this nationalism and stuff like that, but even that is kind of, it's sketchy. But maybe for today we could, say the question of patriotism is really, do you love your country enough to defend it in a time of crisis? Right, do you love your country, do you love the people of your nation, right, that you're willing to work to better, say, the conditions of life for those people?
Well, it doesn't have to be attached to a country. Can it be just, you love people enough to fight for people? It doesn't have to be contained in a country or not.
Yeah, I guess you can be a patriot of a human race. But the thing that we're confronted with today, and Julianne might go into later, is the question of the nation state. And why nations themselves are important, right? In terms of the strategic situation right now, right, when nation states are under attack, right, from this globalization system that's being created, we have to ask the question and try to figure out why nation states might be important. Mm-hmm.
Maybe you see, I used to see a difference or an incompatibility with the being a citizen of the world and at the same time a patriot. Like if these two terms don't fit together. But I mean, the thing is to find a way. Like Frederick Bliss, in the opening of his book on the national system of political economy, says, "Et la patrie et l'humanité." And humanity and the patrie, you know?
All the one. Mm-hmm.
So the thing is, how do we found this coincidence of both in our definition of patriotism?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like the United States. I mean, this idea of patriotism in the United States is not merely about making the U.S. better, right? But I mean, the whole idea, the conception of why the United States was created was to create an example, like a beacon for the rest of the world, right? And you know, Henry Carey in The Harmony of Interest says, in order to improve the state of mankind throughout the world, all we have to do is better ourselves. Is improve our own nation, right? Improve our own people. Things like this, where the yeah, I mean, you can't really separate the two. If you love your people, I mean, there's a certain conception there that you're not distinguishing between your people and those people, right? I mean, maybe there's an idea there that Liss goes through that. That we have nation states for a reason, right? Because nation states are the only institutions we have which are capable of promoting the general welfare. So in that sense, they're necessary to protect people from, say, predatory financier interests. But yeah, there's no real contradiction between patriotism and a love of all humanity, right? And the American example demonstrates that. In the 19th century. So, in terms of Canada, right, this question of patriotism is going to be crucial in the coming period, right, when, as this economic situation develops, or degenerates, depending on how you look at it, and people are going to have to make some tough choices, and we as a youth movement have a lot of work ahead of us, which we need help to carry out. But it comes down to this question, and we're going to look at a few people today, because this question of patriotism, because one of the things that I realized through this project, and that other people who've either read the paper or you know, talked to, and Alex have talked to, the fellow who did a bunch of the research on it, is that the people we're going to look at today have basically been eliminated from Canadian history. And we've got to think about why these people aren't in the history books, when they clearly had incredible influence over the shaping of our country in the 19th century. So that's something to keep in mind. So today we're going to look at these guys. All right. Now, the actual fight that was going on. Bruce said something interesting yesterday, where you have to understand, like, what was happening in the 19th century in the Western Hemisphere, right, is centered around this question of the struggle between two systems. Okay, and I want to read a quote here from Henry Carey, The Harmony of Interest, which we've published in a book called The Civil War and the American System. And I think that this sets it out, and what I'm going to read here, if we didn't know if it was written by Carey in 1851, we could imagine that this was written yesterday. Okay? So he says, two systems are before the world. One looks to increasing the necessity for commerce, the other to increasing the power to maintain it. One looks to underworking the Hindu and sinking the rest of the world to his level. The other to raising the standard of man throughout the world to our level. One looks to pauperism, ignorance, depopulation, and barbarism. the other to increasing wealth, comfort, intelligence, combination of action, and civilization. One looks to universal war, the other to universal peace. One is the English system. The other we may be proud to call the American system, for it is the only one ever devised, the tendency of which was that of elevating while equalizing the condition of man throughout the world. Like Bruce mentioned yesterday, how this system, whenever it has been applied, has succeeded. And that the whole debate over capitalism and socialism or communism is a false debate. Because really, what you're talking about is the American system or some kind of global financier-run dictatorship. Or a series of puppet governments which function in the same way. So Carey in 1851 published that. Now the fellow that Canada was centered around at the time in the struggle to create a nation here, his name was Isaac Buchanan, and he was a collaborator with Carey. Since Carey's first publication in 1837 is the hypothesis that I have. Now, this question of the British rule in Canada is important to look at, right? And the actual intention of free trade. And a question I think maybe we should examine a bit is, there's a tendency today in like the economics and stuff, people who study economics, is to separate economics from politics. What do people think about that? Do you think that's the right approach?
It's a demon.
It's a demon? To separate the two, or?
Yeah.
Go hand in hand.
Why might that be the case?
Because you need government. Well, the only person that can look towards building something for everybody is a government. And this is, you need a government that's going to look into a system so that everybody gets a fair shake at life or a fair shake at opportunities.
I would say that basically economy and politics goes together because they're made by humans, basically.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to look at how Britain, because this free trade doctrine came out of Britain primarily, right? It was based upon previous stuff, previous writings, but Adam Smith, right, developed these concepts of free trade, and that was followed up by other British economists. Now it's interesting that Smith wrote The Wealth of Nations, or it was printed in the same year as, was it the American Constitution?
1776.
Okay, and The Wealth of Nations was written in
1776.
Yeah, it was printed?
Yeah.
Okay, so there's a coincidence here in what's happening with the intention of the Smith. Now, what's interesting is if this, and List, Friedrich List talks about this a lot, and he's a very interesting fellow to look at. If this is such a great theory, and if it was true what these free trade economists were saying, well, why didn't Britain apply free trade to itself? Why did Britain always seem to have protectionism on its manufacturing? You know, that's an interesting question to ask. And what List goes through in a series of letters is he shows that, you know, Britain was taking this theory, free trade theory, and applying it when it worked to its interest, not applying it when it worked to its interest, right? Trying to force other nations to adopt these policies.
But yeah, like, play a bit of devil's advocate here. Okay, you could also argue that, Britain didn't have a Unitarian thought, and you had those unit capitalist industrialist. That's the like liberal argument, right? Mm-hmm. And you have those the let's fall down the big landowners. And big landowners lived off agriculture and they didn't care about industry and they weren't interested in liberalization because it might compete with their wheat that is not competitive. Mm-hmm. So the liberalism became big or acceptable once like, the capitalists represented enough of a critical mass within Britain's economy so that they could get their views like imposed, I guess, or like popular, because you had more and more people moving to the cities, more and more people in the industries. That's when they had a level of acceptable to watch something like that.
Yeah, well, I think you got to look too at the role of the British East India Company and the ascension of the British East India Company in England. Right, and yeah, there were struggles going on within Britain at the time. Right, and we're going to talk about that a little bit, an event that happened in 1846. But this free trade doctrine, see that, you know, there's something called the Haileybury School in England, or in Britain, which was the training center for the people who worked in the British East India Company, the civil servants and so on. And this is where Smith worked. This is where Thomas Malthus, I mean, he was an economist. Right, we know this guy, and he was the head of the School of Economics at Haileybury for quite some time. and you know, other fellows like Ricardo coming out of here. I think Bentham probably came out of Haileybury. John Stuart Mill. So, and then you had a bunch of other people who also adopted these free trade ideas. But the imperial, so you got to look at the British Empire and the role that that was playing, and that the British Empire was run by private corporations. Right, the British East India was a private company. And that they were pushing these policies internationally, like with Kennan and the Empire, right? That they got the Empire in a system where Canada, India, the various colonies were in a situation where they were not allowed to develop manufacturing. They weren't allowed to have tariffs. They weren't allowed to have any kind of industrial development. They were merely supposed to be agricultural and raw material suppliers for the British manufacturing. And that this is the fundamental root of it. Now, Britain was also using this as this. It wasn't just economics; it was a political tool. And List goes through something at a certain point. And Buchanan also, in one of his major publications, deals with the question of Germany. And at a certain point, Germany had been developing. I think probably in the early 1800s, had been developing. You know, industries and had been becoming fairly prosperous. But Britain convinced Germany to adopt free trade with England. And the thing was that Britain would supply Germany with its manufactured goods, and Germany would supply England with its agricultural goods. Now, for a few years, this worked really well. You know, the value of land increased in Germany. The farmers were very wealthy at the time. I mean, this is the beginning of the industrial period, really. So you still had the concentration, you know, the primary interest in a nation was the health of its agriculture. But see, so you have, apparently it was a good situation. But then Britain changed its policy, and it threw its tariff back up on agriculture. And what happened in Germany?
When was that?
This is the period. I mean, List is writing in 1827, so I'd say the first decades of the 1800s. I can look this up for you if you want. We can look into that. But this was the period I believe he was talking about, either the late 1700s, early 1800s.
Okay.
But a few years after Britain and Germany had this agreement, Britain reneged. Threw back up tariffs on its agricultural imports, and the German economy collapsed. Meanwhile, like over the period where they had the free trade agreement, German manufacturing had been decimated, right? Because the German markets were flooded with cheap or cheaper British manufactured products. So Britain used free trade as a political tool to destroy its enemies. You know, it was trying to convince France. You know, it's like, hey, you should have a free trade agreement where we'll supply you with manufactured goods and you can give us all the wine that you want. It did it to Portugal, and Portugal lost its sovereignty for a period of time. So we also have to look then at there's a constant attempt by Britain to get the United States to adopt free trade as well. And the reason that List is writing these letters in the 1827 is to try to convince the United States not to go with these free trade policies. Because he saw the effect that it had on Germany, he saw the effect it had on other nations. Right? And at the same time, I want to, in the mid to late 1840s, I believe there was a book written in the United States called Essays on the Progress of Nations, and written by a fellow named Ezra Champion Seaman. And he writes, he's comparing the effect of free trade in Canada and looking at the development of Canada and the United States in the early 1800s. And he says, though the ratio of the increase of the population has been greater in Canada than in the United States, yet their increase of wealth has barely kept pace with the population, and they are as poor as they were half a century since. They have enjoyed the blessings of free trade with England all the time. We have only a part of the time. Whenever we have attempted to supply ourselves by our own industry with the comforts and necessaries of life, we have improved our condition as a people. And during the intervals of free trade and large importations of foreign goods, we have relapsed again into a condition bordering on bankruptcy. While the Canadians, who have been constantly exhausted and kept so poor by free trade, to be unable to get sufficient credit to have even the ups and downs of prosperity and bankruptcy in succession. So because of free trade, we couldn't even have the boom and bust cycles that the United States would have when it went between protectionism and free trade. Right? So that's an American perspective on Canada in the early 1800s. So we have to understand that this political connection to this policy, right, and also understand what's going on today. Now, What did Canada look like in this time? Well, in 1837, we had the twin rebellions of Upper and Lower Canada. Right? These were actually run by, there's a fellow, William Lyon Mackenzie, and another fellow, what was his first name?
Louis-Joseph
Papineau. Well, both these guys were connected to American Republican circles. Right? And, So you had these rebellions organized simultaneously, right? Which failed, and then martial law was imposed upon the colony for the next 4 years. Now these rebellions had been conducted because you had certain quite a bit of unhappiness and discontent in the colony, especially like from that quote. Here you've got Canada, right, with the same potential as the United States, really. For development and for prosperity and so on, and yet constantly poor. And they see that their southern neighbor, right, advancing, building industries, all kinds of canal works and infrastructure projects are going on, different things like this where you see massive progress going on. And here they are stuck in this backward northern nation. So in response to these rebellions in 1841, you get something called responsible government. Now today in history classes they tend to teach that responsible government was one of the first steps leading towards sovereignty for Canada, right, and to nationhood. But it's just a joke, it's a farce. Because all Britain did is it gave to, basically gave Canada the right to make unimportant decisions about daily life, you know, how, you know, you can regulate your societies or pass different legislation on this or that, but the great questions of defense, trade, protectionism, or free trade, things like this, right, these were still in the hands of the imperial government, right, that we gave, they gave, it was a token gesture by the British to appease the population in the colonies, right, but the intent was never to give us autonomy. And at the same time, they controlled, see, Canada was run by an oligarchy at the time based in Montreal, a situation where you had the bankers and the merchants in collusion to basically keep Canada impoverished. So, and the way that they would do that, see, if you were importing all your manufactured goods, right, and you were exporting your agricultural products, you tended to have what we call today like a current account deficit, right? So then what's happening is to deal with that, you send your gold out of your country. Well, under the system we had at the time, or your specie, the gold was the basis of the banking system, right? Banks could issue a certain amount of currency based upon how much gold they had in their vault. Now, if this gold is leaving the country, then the amount of currency in circulation has to contract. So then you've got less resources to loan out to farmers, industrialists, people like this, for different kinds of projects. Right? And what this leads to is increased interest rates. And one of the big problems that Buchanan was trying to address over the years was this problem of looting the population by usury, right? 20-30% interest rates on loans to farmers and people like this, which was just wrecking the economy, right? So when Seaman is talking about Canada being kept in a continuous state of impoverishment, I mean, this is one of the ways that it was being done, right? The merchants were basically, you know, our gold was leaving the country and the bankers were making a killing. So now in 1841, then you get this responsible government, right? And over the next decade, you see some attempts here to actually create working government by several people: Baldwin, LaFontaine, and a fellow named William Hamilton Merritt. Merritt was a major collaborator with Buchanan. And Merritt, actually, he was the father of probably the most important canal work in Canada, which is called the Welland Canal, which connected Lake Erie with Lake Ontario. Right? This is what bypassed Niagara Falls. And he's also, Bruce mentioned this last night, the St. Lawrence Seaway project of a series of canals and different infrastructure works, which I guess Roosevelt was promoting?
He was promoting it, but it wasn't built until the 50s
after
the war.
Well, that idea was originally came from William Hamilton Merritt in the 1820s and 30s. He was actually an American-born fellow who moved to Canada. And a lot of the early canal works in Canada were financed by Americans. It wasn't by the British or the Canadian banks or anything like that. It was from the United States. So, now over this period then you start to get a development in Canada of a certain sense of you get a certain core of people around Merritt and Buchanan, Baldwin and LaFontaine to a certain extent, who have a sense of creating a nation. Okay, they've been given even though like this idea of responsible government is a farce, they do now have a parliament where Quebec and Ontario are starting to work together. Right, and they've got a reform movement which is trying to do things for the country. Right, they're trying to develop some kind of a nation. Now, in 1848 to 1851 is a crucial period when like a vast amount of legislation is passed regarding railroads, canal works, infrastructure in general. You start to see the beginning of some industry creeping up despite the free trade system. But then something, the British, there's a response to this. They send over a bunch of young radicals, which became known as the Young Canada Movement. Now, what this was this is an operation by the British Empire. Right? Yeah. Lords Palmerston and Russell, who had also unleashed these young, you know, young Europe movements, young Germany at the time as well.
Russell?
Lord John Russell, Bertrand Russell's grandfather. So these guys basically came over to Canada. There's four or five of them, these young fellows. They set up a bunch of newspapers. And the idea was that they were going to intervene into this reform movement of Baldwin, LaFontaine, and Merritt, which Buchanan was also associated with. They're going to intervene into that and basically sabotage the whole thing. Right? Because here's an actual threat. You had a developing sense of nationalism, patriotism in Canada, of people that were working to create something good, to actually take Canada away from its focus on agriculture, right, and move towards developing a real nation. And within a couple of years, these guys managed to sabotage the whole thing. So in 1851, the government collapses, and you don't see another functioning government in Canada for, probably 20 years, roughly. Now, all of this infrastructure stuff, it's interesting to think how, you got this as a response to something that happened in 1846. You know, and like what we're proposing today with massive industrial works and things like this, right, is that we're facing, we've got an economic crisis, major depression, right, all kinds of unemployment. Well, that was the situation 1848 to 1851. And in a sense, this question of free trade again, like what Germany did to, or what Britain did to Germany, was also done to Canada in 1846. Something called the repeal of the Corn Laws. So at the time, you had an agreement where Canada was going to supply its agricultural goods to Britain, right? And other members of the British Empire could do that. And that was like the one benefit that Canada had, was being a subject, a colony of the British. But in 1846, Britain says, well, we're not going to do that anymore. They dropped the tariffs against countries like the United States, and Britain is flooded with cheap agricultural products, and Canada, it nearly collapses. Right? In a year, it's in a major, major, major depression, 1847. Right? So you get this government that starts, well, we're gonna build our way out of this. And it was working. Right? Again, this question of free trade, right? Why would you be dependent upon a foreign power to support your economy? I mean, are you a sovereign nation if you become dependent upon either foreign imports or foreign exports? Right? If Britain makes a decision, right, to change its economic policy, and you have a depression, right, and your people go bankrupt and begin to starve, well, that's maybe not a very good policy. Maybe you need to change something in your own country. Right, and this is what these guys started to do. So you've got this intersection then, right, happening in the early 40s between people, agents of the British Empire who have come over, and they're basically trying to disrupt any kind of positive progress that's being made in the country. And you've also at the same time got people that are starting to realize, well, this whole British-Canadian situation isn't so hot, right, where we're basically at the mercy of, you know, the whims and the shifting political winds of the British Parliament. In the British Empire. So they say, well, we've got to look for different options here. Now, at the time, remember Thomas Malthus, right? This guy was an economist out of the Haileybury School, right? And again, this is the guy who's saying all the world's depopulated. Remember Canada, you know, 7% of the country is settled. There's a lot of free space here. And we've got a certain pessimism in the culture. Just like now, I mean, you know, Canada's not in great shape economically. You know, you've got a lot of people in pretty cheap, shitty jobs, right? We see this on the street when we organize, the pessimism, right? The sense of impotence, that there's nothing we can do, or there's nothing that the people think that they can do. So these guys, Merritt and Buchanan, right? They're trying to figure, well, how do we deal with this? Right? How do we launch industrialization in Canada? Well, we've got to bust some of these axioms. Right? We've got to change the way that people are thinking about themselves. We've got to change the way that they think about their nation and the potential of this country. So now Merritt knew this young man named Thomas Coltrane Kiefer, who was an engineer who had worked under him and who had known his father. Merritt knew Kiefer's father very well. So Merritt commissions Kiefer, as well as some Montreal businessmen, to write a pamphlet called The Philosophy of Railroads. Now this is 1849, and there's less than 60 miles of railroad track in all of British North America. Remember, we're talking about this, and you got 60 miles of track. Right, and I think basically 60 miles went somewhere from south of Montreal down to the U.S. border, and that was the extent of the railroading that we had in Canada. Kind of like that idea that, you know, in Africa the railroad went from the mine to the port, and that was about it. So they say, well, this has to change, right? Because we're not going to have any kind of industrialization without railroading. Right, they saw what was going on in the States, and they saw the effect of this, just like they saw the effect of building canals, right, on the ability to transport goods. So, Kiefer writes this pamphlet, and it gets reprinted four times. It gets printed in French. It gets used in New England, down in various states, to also promote railroading. Now, what's interesting is, and you get a sense of how these guys thought about the nature of man, as compared to a society at the time which is dominated by Malthusianism, in a sense, right, a very pessimistic or Adam Smith idea, right, that we're merely beasts, slaves to our sense perception, right, we can't know truth, and all we can think about is our immediate self-interest, right, satisfying various desires, pleasures, things like that. And what Kiefer is very explicit about is that there is a civilizing effect to scientific and technological progress, right? That bringing the railroad to Canada would improve not only the culture, but the morality of the people, right? And what these guys were proposing and promoting in this pamphlet was the moral perfectibility of man, right? That we had the capacity to improve ourselves and our environment, right, and our relationships amongst each other through scientific and technological progress, through progress in culture and the arts, right, and that these were all inextricably tied. And this is what this pamphlet lays out, right, and this was distributed all through the colony, right, and it had the effect of completely shifting the way that people were thinking at the time. Right, and this launched the whole process of railroad development in Canada. Buchanan then, a couple years later, in the early 50s, launches a project called the Great Western Railway, which connected Sarnia, right, to Hamilton and Toronto and to the Niagara region, right, which was also connected to, went through the Buffalo and, you know, various places in the United States over to Detroit. Right, you had other projects. The Grand Trunk Railroad was begun, which is essentially the main artery of Canada right now, from Toronto through to Montreal and on into the States. Right, but it was this pamphlet, right, intervening into the society with a new idea, right, an idea which would break the axioms of pessimism, which were preventing people from, it's so much money, how can we afford it, all this stuff, what if it doesn't work out, all this kind of crap, right? I mean, it's the same, we're talking about the same problems today that people have in their minds, the same axioms which prevent them from acting to better their society. Right, and these guys actually managed to break that. And over the next decade, despite the effect of the Young Canada movement and the fragmentation of the reform movement, the collapse of this progressive government in 1851, you get a real revolution starting to happen in Canada. Now, you have another depression, though, in 1857, which I can't particularly remember why it happened, but that's not important.
What?
1857. What's important is the response from Buchanan, right? And what he does is he goes out, and now this guy, you got to remember about this guy, is he was pamphleting the whole time, all through the 50s. Right, he's basically spreading the ideas of Henry C. Carey all through Canada. At one point in one of his publications, he says that his intention is to bring Carey's work to Canada and publish it by the millions. Right, that he's going to spread these ideas. And what he was introducing in the 50s was the fact that Canada, if it wanted to survive, needed to adopt the American system. It needed to adopt protectionism. It needed to separate the executive from the legislative. Right, which is not what we have in the parliamentary system, right? But the purse, the treasury should be in the people's hands, right? The ability to create money should be in the people's hands, right? That we shouldn't have a country governed by a governor general, which is appointed by the Queen of England, right? That even the parliament as it was at the time really was subservient to the governor general, could be deposed at any time. So in 1858, a year after the Depression, he's already organizing the industrialists in Canada, the industrialists and the merchants in Toronto, in Montreal, and he gets these guys together, and they basically create a proposal, and they go to the government, and they say, this is the tariff that you need to adopt, right? We figured out basically what we need, figured out the cost of production, right? We figured out how much we need to make a profit, you know, basically what the British are, you know, what's being imported, what we need to set up in terms of a tax upon imports in order to protect our industries, right? And the government basically adopted this policy as it stood. And this is the first time in Canadian history that you had a tariff designed specifically to protect and promote Canadian industry. This is the first time, and Buchanan is acknowledged as the leading force behind this. Okay. So then, over the next few years leading up to 1863, this is the key period when, now remember, you've got these guys who are saying, well, how are we going to create a sovereign nation? How are we going to create a nation when, at the time, sovereignty meant having steel production and railroads? Right, but, I mean, we're still trapped in this, basically, this free trade system with Britain. I mean, how do we get out of this? What do we do? What are our options? They say, well, there's this republic just to the south, which is pretty progressive, doing despite its particular faults and problems, seems to be advancing. Well, that's where our interest lies. You know, when these guys see, I mean, Buchanan is connected through New York, through New York mercantile circles with Carey. You know, he's very close to the owner of a paper which Carey was publishing a lot of his articles in, this guy named Horace Greeley. Merritt is from the States. Merritt has many connections down in Washington. So he's going to say, well, the policy is going to be a customs union with the United States, where Canada and the States will have free trade amongst themselves, but we're going to have a tariff system, a common tariff against Britain. And we're going to go to this Britain and we're going to say, unless you adopt this policy for us, unless you allow us to go this way, you're going to lose us. Right? Because we're not going to stay with this free trade system. And they call this an American Zollverein. And it was modeled upon what Friedrich List had brought to Germany in the beginning around 1819. Right? Because and Buchanan in his major publication in 1864 spends a lot of time looking at the effects of this Zollverein, or this customs union, which List had created, right, and the effect of that on the German economy. Right, and saying this worked, right? Germany is a flourishing, productive nation now, right? And it's mostly because of this. So he's saying, well, we need to have the same thing in Canada, right? And the idea now is not like NAFTA. He was not proposing, you know, the 19th century version of NAFTA. Right? The idea was to have rapid and infrastructure and industrial development, right, amongst these two nations, to have a market for Canadian agriculture, and to rid itself of this imperial control coming out of Britain. And this was the intent. And they're pushing this intensively all through from 1858 up to 1863. In 1863, Buchanan gives a speech in Toronto where he outlines this policy. I want to read a section from this.
Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going to prevent Canada to become dependent from the U.S. in that case? To invert the rules, the U.S. becomes Britain for us.
You mean today?
No, in that time.
In that time?
That trade between mm-hmm. Canada and U.S.
Mm-hmm.
What was going to allow us to develop our industry? And how were we preventing the U.S. from becoming what Britain was to us?
Well, see, there's this policy that Britain had called the centralization of manufactures, which was that, you had from 1848 to 1851, you had a government in Canada which was promoting industrial development, was passing a lot of various legislation on railroading, canal works, things like this to get the Canadian economy going. And what was Britain's response? Well, it deployed this young Canada operation to sabotage that effort, right? At the same time, you've got these factors around like the Bank of Montreal, you've got the Hudson's Bay Company, you've got these different imperial assets in Canada which are manipulating politics, which are keeping the nation from developing. Or you got different forces like this. You got a guy named George Brown, which I go into more in the paper. This guy owned what today is the Globe and Mail. And this guy became associated with these radicals of Britain. And George Brown was the main opposition in Canada at the time to industrialization. Mm. Right? I mean, the Globe and Mail was the most widely read paper. And it was the most important, it was the most powerful means that anybody had in the colony at the time for influencing popular opinion and public opinion. So you got to understand how Britain was, you got to look at how Britain was manipulating Canada.
At the time, the U.S. had a more developed industry, so it could have just ended up being the same situation. So what prevented that?
Well, I think the thing you've got to look at is that Canada had massive capabilities for industrial works because of its water. Like all these rivers, I mean, at the time, water power was very important for running a lot of these different kinds of mills. And, I mean, we had some industry. But I think you got, I mean, in terms of the free trade thing, the big thing for Canada was having access to the American market for its agricultural goods. Mm-hmm. Okay, and in terms of the United States, what they were trying to create really was this idea of sovereign nations in the Western Hemisphere. And, I mean, these guys were aware. I mean, you have a colony of your main, your great enemy just to the north. I mean, this is a problem. Right, so in terms of how the Zollverein would have been constructed, right, you've got to look at it from the standpoint of how the United States had an interest in seeing Canada develop as a nation.
So it's almost like benevolent, right?
Yeah.
It's a one-way thing so that we can develop.
Well, it's not just a one-way thing, though. I mean, Canada had a lot of, we had a lot to offer the states. You know, we at a certain point, we had a treaty where we gave the U.S. access to fisheries on the East Coast. You know, we had all kinds of resources. You know, where, and the thing is, if you look at how you're going to help both countries can develop from this. You know, if you create a system where maybe Canada would have tariffs on certain things to allow its industries to develop. Right? But you approach it from the standpoint that Buchanan and Kerry were looking at was how do you create a system of sovereign nations, right, as a counterforce to the role that the British are playing in the world at the time. Well, actually, what I want to read is the response that Brown has to this speech by Buchanan. Okay? But I think this really lays it out. Brown was the main asset in Canada at the time for the British Empire. Okay, and he was a pawn in the sense of this Young Canada movement. And this is what he writes as a response to Buchanan's speech in 1863. It says, the conservative press are all unanimous in their expressions of its approval. It was a great speech, a magnificent speech, a regular screecher. They endorse the sentiments it contains, the principles it sets forth, and not for many a long day has such an excellent speech been given to the world, so they all declare. In other words, England must give up free trade, a principle which, the farther it is carried out, the greater has her prosperity become. A principle which is seated deep down in the hearts of the people. A principle, the correctness and beneficial power of which is recognized by the greatest thinkers from Adam Smith downwards. Or else what? Why, the people of the colonies, smarting under the intolerable wrong done them, will rise against the imperial authority and forswear forever their allegiance to the crown. He, Mr. Buchanan, believed that, as a necessary consequence of the free trade legislation of England, Canada would require England to assent to two things. First, an American Zollverein. Second, Canada to be made neutral territory in the time of any war between England and the United States. Only this, now remember, 1863, what's going on? Civil War? Only this can save us from annexation. What a modest proposition. If not, according to Mr. Buchanan, the inevitable result is that we shall, as did the 13 colonies, become separated from the parent state. Buchanan intends that Canada should be left to herself to protect her territory, with the power of peace or war thus given to us, with all British commercial interest in us destroyed by this Zollverein. What else should we be but an independent country? God, no! Not an independent country! That was the response of the British assets in Canada. Now, it's also interesting to look at this question of the Civil War, right? Because you had an interesting thing happen the year before. There's something called the Trent Affair, I think in the early parts of the war, late 1861. The Trent Affair, which is where a British ship was caught with several Confederate agents on board by a Union captain. And this was a breach of the apparent British neutrality in the Civil War. And people freaked out over that in Britain and in the United States. And the response of Britain was to send an army to Canada. They sent 15,000 troops in 1862, early 1862 as a response. They basically stationed them along the border and garrisoned them in the cities and the towns to basically keep the population in Canada under control, right, and to also threaten the U.S. with a potential second front, right, to threaten the Union. Now, these patriots around Buchanan and Merritt, right, these guys saw an opportunity here. It's like, wow, I mean, now with the Trent Affair, geez, I mean, the U.S., I mean, there's some people are threatening an invasion of Canada. You know, we've got this British army here. Well, listen, I mean, we obviously need to be able to defend ourselves, right? We're this colony. We've got all this territory. I mean, 15,000 troops. Well, I mean, we should create a militia. And Britain, you should finance that militia. And the militia should be 50,000 active troops and 50,000 reserve troops. So 100,000 men should be trained to fight, financed by Britain, to defend the colony. To defend the colony from quote-unquote foreign powers. Right. So this is kind of interesting. Now, Britain wasn't so stupid. And they used Brown to actually sabotage the bill, the legislation that was brought up to vote in the Canadian Parliament, which would have created that militia. And Brown was able to sabotage it. The militia bill failed and the government collapsed. We still needed a militia, but it wasn't going to be 100,000 men. And what was finally decided upon later in the year was 25,000 men kept in reserve with poor training and really no weaponry. So it was just a another token gesture, like 1841. Now what's interesting is when Buchanan, he had his own proposal, and what he proposed was a militia of 240,000 men. Right, of 60, and he would have four groups of 60,000, which would be rotating once every year, and they would spend at least 1 month or 2 months of that year in training. Right, so you have, in a sense, a citizen army. Right, with 60,000 troops, it would always be roughly, would have had military training within a year, roughly, of any kind of conflict or crisis breaking out, where they could have been mobilized. But that too, of course, was not implemented. You get a sense here. I mean, there's an attempt here by these people, right, to mobilize around this crisis and use the crisis as a means of promoting sovereignty in Canada. Right, but again, the British are not—they're not so stupid as to let something like that happen. You know, or what's 15,000 troops to 100,000? Even if maybe those British troops are better trained, you know, that's a big, big difference. So this is going on, and now this period in it's really crucial to think about, right? Like 1861 to 1865, right, and what's happening in Canada. You've got the Zollverein being promoted. You've got Buchanan, who has actually been mobilizing the United States, right, and is creating networks and working with networks in the States who agree with the Zollverein proposal, right, where there have been reports submitted to the U.S. Treasury saying this has got to be our policy, right, that this is going to be great for Canada, great for the United States. Talking about how the United States actually benefited from the tariff of 1858, which seems strange. Well, we had a tariff put up against us, right? But there was actually increased trade between Canada and the U.S. over that time period, as Canada created all kinds of industry. Thousands of new industries popped up in a couple years after 1858. The Americans recognized this. Canada recognized this, or the circles around Buchanan. Now you've got this war going on. 1863. What happened in the summer of 1863? You had Gettysburg, I believe, right? Which is a turning point in the Civil War. 3 months later, Buchanan gives this address laying out the proposal for the Zollverein and saying this is where the Canadian people need to go. Right? We need to basically cut our ties with Britain and ally ourselves with the Union. You have the fight over the militia bill. Right. Things of this nature. This is all going on. Now, in February of 1864, the beginning of the year, Buchanan publishes a book called On the Relations of the Industry of Canada with the Mother Country in the United States. I have a photocopied version of it here, but we actually have one of the original books from that year. And this is where he basically lays out all his economic theory. He reprints many of his different pamphlets. And he says, the Zollverein is the fundamental, that's the core principle. He reprints an article by the Marquis de Lafayette from 1832, which talks about creating republican institutions around a monarchy. Right? He reprints parts of articles by Henry Carey, reprints parts of speeches by Henry Clay, who he referred to in the early 1840s as the greatest living American. You know, so what he basically lays out is a platform for Canada, an economic platform. And immediately, the response from Brown and these young Canada circles, which are still around, right, and the Reform Party that they've managed to take over since they came to Canada in 1849 is a series of slanders, right, where they're attacking him repeatedly in the months afterwards. And Buchanan regularly referred to George Brown as the Canadian Robespierre, who, whereas the French Robespierre, when he came up against opposition, you know, killed these people. What Brown did was he set out to ruin their character to the extent that he could, right, by using his mercenary press. So the Canadian Robespierre, but less manly. Could I actually get some more tea, if possible?
Oui.
So he lays out this platform, and 3 months later, a new government forms. And Buchanan is appointed to the most powerful position in Canada, called the President of the Executive Council. And basically what you had at the time was you had people would be elected, right, from like today to our Parliament. You know how today the Prime Minister then forms a cabinet, right, chooses different ministers and things like this? Well, we had something similar to that, except you had a council that would be chosen amongst the parties, right, and the president would head this council, and then above the president of the council, you had the governor general. Okay, whereas today, the governor general is more of a figurehead. He doesn't, or she doesn't interfere so much with how things are functioning. At the time, the governor general was still the head of government had a lot of influence. But the president of the executive council was second in command. Merritt, in 1848 to 51, had been president of the executive council. And in that time, remember, this is when all the great infrastructure works were going on. So Buchanan now has his chance. Now, if he's been appointed to this position 3 months after having published this book, right, this platform, I mean, clearly there's an intent in Canada amongst the major parties, amongst the political circles, that this is the plan, right, that this is what we're going with as a nation, right, that we're going to actually break with Britain, right, we're going to break with this free trade stuff, and we're going to adopt the American system. Right, we're going to bring these reforms about. Well, what was the response from Britain?
You can do it.
Yeah. They said, yeah. Hardly. Well, they used their assets. Like George Brown. Now, something that's important here is that to go back to this question of this Young Canada movement. See, one of the things that they were doing is, yeah, they wanted to destroy what Merritt was doing and Baldwin and LaFontaine, right, from 48 to 51. But more importantly is they were sent here to destabilize the colony as a whole. And now you want to find out where the roots of the problems between Quebec and English Canada come from? You got to understand the role of this Young Canada movement. And the fact that these guys throughout the 50s were basically pushing various populist measures, right? Like the kind of stuff you hear today between the provinces, right? Oh, the fiscal imbalance, you know? We want more from the federal government. We pay more taxes than we get back from the government for different projects and all this kind of stuff. You know, where at the time, they're saying, well, you have Upper and Lower Canada. It's like, you know, Upper Canada was Ontario, or what today is Ontario, and then Lower Canada was Quebec. Right, and these guys around Brown, they're all centered in Toronto. And they're saying, oh, Upper Canada, I mean, we've got most of the industry now. We're the big brother, you know, we're contributing all kinds of revenues to the treasury, and what do we get for it? Nothing. You know, we've got more population than Lower Canada, and these people in Lower Canada have the same number of seats in the parliament. They're getting, you know, we're giving them all kinds of wealth, you know, all kinds of revenue that comes out of our pocket. You know, what's up with this? This is completely unfair.
English.
Yes. I mean, this is what they're doing. I mean, then you get different attacks. I mean, Brown is attacking the Catholics and all kinds of stuff. They're manipulating different problems between the Protestants and the Catholics and all kinds of stuff. But you see that you got to look at this period, and we need to do more research into these guys. Looking at more of their writing, but it seems to me that like a lot of the problems today, right, the way that we interact comes out of this. And what these guys managed to do is to completely destabilize Canadian politics, and through the 50s up into the 60s it just got worse and worse. And by the beginning of the Civil War, of course, which is a major destabilizing factor, you could no longer really have functioning government in Canada. And you had something like four or five governments form from 1860 up until the spring of 64 when Buchanan becomes president of the executive council. But there was kind of an impasse that had been reached, right, where nobody really knew what to do. That something had to change. That this system of government that Britain had created in 1841 was not functioning. And you had two ways you could go. You could go with Brown's approach, which was to dissolve the particular situation they had then, but maintain the British parliamentary system, right? Create a federal government and then provincial governments. Or you could go with Buchanan and begin the process of creating a republic. Now, what Brown and these guys managed to do was, over the next 3 months, to basically bring about the collapse of Buchanan's government in mid-June of 1864, before it really had a chance to initiate these policies. And they did it based upon the kind of populism that had infected the society, right? The kind of sophistry and small-mindedness, well, which we see today, right? But he did it by through focusing on the divisions, right? Whereas here's Buchanan, who considered himself the greatest Canadian patriot, right? Who's trying to find a conception based upon what the United States has done, right, to create a nation, you know, with a purpose, right? The betterment of its society, the betterment of its people. But because of the British influences and the money and the power, Brown was able to mobilize his forces to bring down that government. Now, what happened then? Well, we know what happened after that, right? Several years later, we got Confederation. Right? Buchanan was out in 64, and Brown replaced him as president of the Executive Council. Later that year, Buchanan's business fell into major financial difficulty, and a couple years later went bankrupt. His brother, in 62, who had really been the major, the person really running Buchanan's mercantile businesses and things like this, which had allowed Buchanan to do all this political work, had died in a hunting accident in England. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a bit suspicious. So Buchanan basically was pushed out of the Executive Council and later on in early 65 retired from government to deal with this crisis in his business. So he was neutralized. Meanwhile, Merritt had died in 62. Kiefer was still around, but he didn't have the power of these other guys. And you had a breaking up of the networks which were pushing for a republic in Canada. So an opportunity was lost. And what you had then in 1867 was the passing of the British North America Act by the imperial government. So we were born without having been conceived. And we got to look and understand how that period, right, affects today. Right, and how we came about as a nation affects the way that we see ourselves and our ability to make sovereign decisions. Right? Think about how often Canadians are looking elsewhere for some kind of justification for themselves, they're very insecure. You know, we always want to be world class. You know, we want our country to be world class, or this or that. You know, but there's no pride in actually being Canadian. We have no history that we know of that we could really be proud of. In many ways, what Buchanan was doing, this question of patriotism, right, was destroyed. But I mean, this guy Buchanan. I want to give you a sense, because I haven't really dwelt on this, but what this guy did. I mean, you got the tariffs, you got the Zollverein and so on. But there's a bit of a list here that of things that he created. So he came to Canada in the early 1830s, and almost immediately he started doing this. Okay. So he was the founder, besides his mercantile business, he was the founder of churches, educational systems, hospitals, asylums, newsrooms and commercial exchanges, boards of trade, national and immigration societies, insurance offices, banks, trust and loan companies, steam navigation, telegraphing, etc., 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 and last but not least, railroading.
Oh, really? Who's that?
That was Buchanan. In 1846, when he had the passing of the Corn Laws, he went to England and started organizing the labor movement there for the next 5 years. He was pamphleteering, and basically he was right in the middle of the fight against free trade, right from the time of the repeal of the Corn Laws. Right, he was engaged. I mean, he was like engaged with the circles around Russell, trying to get them to go back from what they'd done. Right, I mean, he was writing letters to the highest levels in Britain, saying, "Listen, you're going to lose this colony. Right, that it's not in your interest to loot us anymore. You know, you can't keep doing this." He's building railroads. The other thing, you need a history, right? You want to be a nation? You need to have a history. And he and Merritt in the late 50s commissioned people to actually start collecting the stories of Canada, right? To start compiling a history. Because you can't, yeah, you're no nation without a history. Right? And he commissioned this fellow, Henry James Morgan, in the early 60s to write a book, which is at McGill, which you can go and look at if you want, which is really neat. They've got a couple copies, called Sketches of Celebrated Canadians. It's about 800 or 900 pages, and it's a series of short biographies on great Canadians in our history, right? The people who define the nation, define the culture. Right? And actually, this guy Morgan wrote the biography for Buchanan, and at first I was like, man, this guy, I mean, this is just about the most glowing biography that I've ever read. But then, Buchanan commissioned the guy to write the book, so, okay, it makes a bit more sense. But then Buchanan, when he became president, he actually hired Morgan to be his personal secretary. You know, but you see this fellow who says, well, what do you need to build a nation, right? Railroads, all these different institutions. Remember, Hamilton was his main, that's where he lived. Hamilton's the center of the steel industry in Canada. In North America, actually, we have probably the best steel company on the planet is in Hamilton, Ontario, called Dofasco. Right now it's in the process of being bought by Krupp. But we have that.
Is that corrupt?
Yeah, it's short form for corrupt now. I don't know. Krupp works. But, I mean, there's a whole bunch of these monolithic steel companies that are trying to buy it up right now. So it would be nice if Canada intervened to actually prevent that from happening. Whether or not that'll happen is yet to be seen. But see, we have to get a sense of, see, here is somebody, right, that we need to bring to Canada. And here's an example of somebody who actually set out to build a nation. Right? And in the end, he was destroyed for really what he was doing. You know, his businesses were ruined, political life was brought to an end. Right? But he did what he had to do. This question of a patriot, right? This is where we are today. You know, what it's going to take to create a nation here. You know, starting to bring this history out is an important part. But see, if you look at the U.S. situation and the U.S. history, well, we need some kind of a mission, right? What is it that's going to unify the country, right? What is the purpose of the country? Because you can't really be a nation if you don't have a purpose. Right? What's the U.S. purpose? You know, you've got it in the preamble to the Constitution. You've got it in the Declaration of Independence.
Freedom, prosperity, and something
like that. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Promotion of the general welfare. You know, it's an idea. I mean, you can't express it in a sense in words, but it's there, right? And you get that when you read these documents. There's an idea there that, like what the youth movement in the States is able to do, right, to mobilize the U.S. population, right, what they're doing right now, that you have even this leadership. Look at the leadership produced by the United States. Canada has been incapable of producing that same quality of leadership. What's the, you know, what is the difference there? Right, these are important questions to look at, and a lot of it goes back to how is the nation conceived or not conceived. So these are the questions we have to have in our minds right now at this time in history, right? When if we have a nation or an apparent nation which doesn't see itself as a nation, which sees itself as a bunch of Hobbesian, it's a Hobbesian society. Right? Look at the way the provinces behave. Right? What can I get? How can I beat upon my neighbors and try to get more? Alberta is a great example. Alberta is swimming in cash. It has no debt, no deficit. Right? This is where the oil sands are, or the tar sands are. Right? It's the center of the oil industry in Canada. And what are they doing with all this wealth? One thing they're not doing is they're not sharing it with Canada.
It sent a $500 check to all of Alberta citizens.
So don't you the money?
Everybody's driving SUVs.
Yeah, what kind of country, right? Where you have the Maritimes. You have parts of the area that are parts of the country that are deep in despair and poverty, and you're swimming in cash and you refuse to share? What's lacking in this nation that allows this kind of thing to happen? Right? Now, think about the implication of the kind of economic crisis that we're about to enter into in the coming period. Can Canada as a nation, I mean, in a sense, regardless of a lot of other things, how is Canada going to function in that kind of a crisis? Do we have the capacity to actually mobilize and unite to rebuild by ourselves? Do we have that capability? And right now, it doesn't really look like it. I mean, in a sense, this is when we confront people on the streets with this question of the importance of what's happening in the United States, and say, oh, but this is Canada. Why don't you talk about Canada? Well, Canada doesn't have the capacity to save itself right now. But this is one of the questions we need to address, right? And I think with the youth movement and what we're trying to do, and what we also have to do worldwide, like Kosovo, does Kosovo have this conception? We have to bring these ideas to people, right? Because if we want to survive as a nation, if we want to actually create a republic here, right, we have to address these axioms in the society. And we also have a legacy to maintain and to bring back to life, right, with these republican circles. Like there's this fellow I mentioned last time I gave this class, Lincoln had a guy come up to Canada at the beginning of the Civil War named John Fox Potter. He was the consul general to Canada. And he was sent to Montreal and stationed here to basically keep an eye on the Confederates who were stationed here, right, and also the British, and to basically spy on these networks, report to Lincoln, right, and make sure that things were that we had an idea of what was happening in Canada. At the same time, he was commissioned to start looking into building Republican networks in Canada. And John Fox Potter's correspondence is preserved, and much of it is in the hands of a fellow in Wisconsin who I've spoken to. And at some point, we're going to get that correspondence. We're going to have it here in Montreal, right? And we're going to be able to start investigating the Republican network that Lincoln was trying to set up, right? And to look into a lot of this history. Because this is not, you're not going to find any of this stuff in the history books, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. Right? Buchanan, you're not going to find him in any history books. Right? The British have written the history books. William Hamilton Merritt, where's his name in our histories? It's not there. Without him, I mean, Canada, without the canal works that he was building, that he was promoting, right? The kind of relationship between Canada and the United States that he was helping to promote. I mean, Canada probably couldn't have survived. Kiefer actually laid that out at a certain point, that the Canadian economy with the stuff that Merritt was doing wouldn't have survived like the 1846 repeal of the corn laws. You know, so we have to look at these people, we have to look at Kiefer. We should be reading the philosophy of railroads. And this is, I think it's not a very long work. But, right, but to get this sense of, hey, you have these people who actually changed their whole society and introduced this idea, the moral perfectibility of man, right? Progress, improvement in morality, improvement in culture tied to technological and scientific progress. Right, but this is on the question of patriotism. This is what it means, right? It's tied to this conception of man, tied to this conception that we can better our own environment, right? That we're not just, you know, beasts. We're not just doomed to some shitty backwards society that doesn't even know how to think about itself. So we have a role now to carry on that tradition that Buchanan started, right, and that Merritt started. And that was abandoned, right? And we can do that, but we got to revive it. And that's what the youth movement in Canada, you know, that's what we need to key off of, right? And what's going on in the States, and recognizing, it says at the beginning, everything good that we have in Canada today is as a result of our relationship to the United States, right? And in terms of the divisions and the problems that we have, generally the roots of that are found in our relationship to Britain. Right, but this goes against everything that we're taught, you know, through our history classes and all this kind of stuff. Right, and we got to recognize that. Now, I think that's what I have to say, and I can take some questions now. If there are people who are confused about any of the history itself, or any questions on that, or otherwise. I mean, there's also the national policy and different things like that we can look at.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for that revision of this history. But actually, that show is that Canada is an independent country.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you explain that? I don't understand why it is explained. The situation with Britain, actually, with the Queen, the one who connect the governor, mm-hmm. and the relation, you should the Canadians should pay something to the, I don't know if it's true, but something like that, you should pay something to the Queen, I don't know. Explain the relationship between the two countries.
I think a good way to look at it is, I'll give you
how can you imagine the next future, how can you imagine the
relationship? Like with Britain, you mean? Or how, I mean, like how Britain...
Mainly Britain.
Okay, well, I'll give you an example of a particular person who's pretty important in Canadian history, a fellow named Lord Strathcona. In terms of understanding how Britain would control Canada. So you had this guy who was very much tied to the British oligarchy. And in Canada, see, at a certain point in the 1870s and 80s, this guy was the head of the Bank of Montreal, most powerful bank in Canada at the time. He owned the Canadian Pacific Railway, which is also a major artery for smuggling opium into Canada and the United States. And he also was the president of the Hudson's Bay Company. Right, so what you got to look at is, I mean, even the British Empire as a whole was run through private corporations, private interests, which the Queen and the imperial government would serve, as Bruce mentioned last night. And in Canada, what you got to look at, it's like Buchanan himself recognized in the 1830s that Canada was controlled by an oligarchy centered in Montreal of merchants and bankers, right, who were basically controlling trade and controlling finances in Canada. Right, so that's how Britain was able to control Canada to a great extent. Then of course you get these guys like Brown, George Brown, and different people who act as agents for Britain, promoting British interests, right, who around the time of the Civil War, when Canada was becoming a nation, George Brown spent a weekend with Lord Palmerston at his weekend retreat, and talked about Canadian defense issues. Well, this is all around the same time that the assassination of Lincoln was being organized. I go into that in the paper that I wrote on this. But the thing is, you've got these people that Britain deploys into the country to either destabilize things, to control important institutions, right? But who are going to promote the commercial interests of the British Empire. That was the key. Right? And the way that Canada was structured in 1867 was to give Canada control over, the majority of the messy details of governing, but at the same time leaving British interests in control of the economy, be it the major railroads, the banking systems, the merchants trade and things like this, because that's what the British were really interested in for the most part. Right, was this kind of stuff? How they could continue to loot the colony without having to spend money on its defense or things like that. In terms of the future, well, I think you have to a certain extent the same thing going on today. you have different people, obviously, but it's the same fundamental process. You got to look too at the way that Britain manipulates the United States, right, through Wall Street. Like Wall Street is like Little England. And I think that's the way to look at it.
But are you saying the oligarchies, like in the U.S., for instance, don't have autonomy, in regard to the Britain?
Well, the British Empire was financier-based interests.
Yeah, but now they created Wall Street, you got a financier oligarchy, like right now. Why would they be in any way dependent of Britain, or is it just the ideas that are the same?
Yeah, well, Bruce mentioned this idea of a slime mold last night, where, these different interests, they're independent to a certain extent, but they got a certain common interest as well.
Yeah, but it's not so much that Britain's controlling anymore, it's just the financial oligarchy by itself.
Yeah, but what was the British Empire?
It was a financial oligarchy. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now there's nobody in Britain holding back the U.S. Or is it what you're saying, or are you saying that the ideas are the same, they've been transmitted, and it's the same kind of financial oligarchy, but now, you don't have to have a nationality, they're not necessarily the Venetians, So are you saying that directly some people in Britain are controlling the U.S., or are you just saying that the same ideas are there?
Yeah, I think it's the same ideas.
Well, the Rouge made recently made a specific difference between a real oligarch, someone who's thing with the financial system was a real, like, evil intention to keep, like, some guy like Montague Normand or like George Shultz, who was more into, like, this idea of controlling nation states. And other people, mostly, like, the people in the United States, like, people like, you know, like Bill Gates or, what's his name, like, Warren Buffett, who are big players in the game, like, in order of funneling lots of fake money, right? But don't have the same intention, which you would see in this oligarchy, which would see Canada's independence as a threat. You got like Buffett, maybe he's going to say, okay, so how do I make money out of that? Right? But then you don't have this idea of, well, like Felix Verhaeten, right? Say, I'm going to bring a policy to destroy the potential, right? Which is, I think, there's a big difference between like a British or you can say maybe European oligarchical mentality and some guy that's like a playboy. Like Bruce Wayne.
He called it the relationship between Mephistopheles and Faust.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't read that.
Yeah, that would be...
So you say that right now, actually, some people like in Britain that have like straight direct intentions of direct control, and that kind of mentality would be more diluted in the States, or like in Wall Street, where it'd be more like, how can I make money out of just direct profit? And
yeah, where you have like this idea of free trade being inserted like in the United States, where you have, in a sense, where today you have like a mixed system, but where the Americans have been infected by this idea of free trade.
Yeah. Right?
So you get this mixture in there.
Yeah, but my question is it happening right now? Do you have, like,
yeah.
I mean, presently, do you still have people in Britain telling, like, fuck, Americans have a big economic power. Why would they need somebody in Britain to control them? That,
well, when you talk about wealth, you don't talk about the economic interest.
No, but they're in the U.S., they're Americans. I mean,
yeah, but their allegiance is not towards the American people. They are banks of profit.
Or to Britain. That's just my question.
It is clear that, just look at the policy and the move they make, that their allegiance is much more towards the City of London, the financial interests associated with the British Empire, than with the idea of the American Constitution, or what we are presenting. Just look at the way Wall Street behaves as a financial institution, and it is not following the line of what the nation state of America was supposed to be.
Yeah.
It's following the policy that the British Empire was trying to impose.
Same kind of idea.
Yeah.
But they're not directly controlled by people in Britain.
Well, if you want to have a who's pulling the string on who, I mean,
yeah.
You're talking about the oligarchy, you don't write books on who's who in, you know, oligarchical family, but I mean, just by the policy, you see that there's a common, they share common values.
Yeah.
And after, if you want to push more into like, who's...
Well, we will be having a big article in the next coming JIR on the Baroness Liz Simmons, who is the controller of Lane and Dick Cheney, straight from London. She's a part of the nobility in London, and she's a personal enemy of LaRouche, and she's pulled many scandal operations against LaRouche to try to have a political assassination kind of thing of his power inside the United States, in the Democratic Party. She initiated a huge scandal to be published in newspapers in the Washington Post in the United States.
And you write direct evidence against her?
Yeah, definitely. Right before the Democratic National Convention, to try to destroy the influence of the LaRouche Youth Movement in dumping Dick Cheney. And her and Lynn Cheney, Dick Cheney's wife, are close friends. They're close workers. And she's being implicated in this big port scandal in the United States. You know, they're trying to sell these ports to the Dubai World Port Company. But the scandal now is that, now that scandal has come up, now people are finding out that, oh, and look at this. Most of the ports in the United States are owned by Baroness Liz Simmons and her company, the, I forget what it's called, something in steamship port
P&O.
Yeah, but those are, no, it's very, there are specific people.
Mm-hmm. Or you look at this set of Port Huron more recently, the meeting with Jack Straw, the French and the American. Mm-hmm. And I think you saw this article about the initiative of Jack Straw, the British, to push the United States to this, the policy we have right now for Iran, change these things.
Iran or
Iran? Iran.
It's important to remember too, like that when Buchanan went over to England, right, that you had massive poverty in England, right, during this whole period, and it was worse, like the whole English culture was degenerating, you know, and massive unemployment. And there's a book written by an American fellow named like the Shame and Glory of England or something like this. And where he documents like just how bad it was during this time. So I mean, when we say Britain too, you know, when we talk about the British Empire, you got to differentiate that from the majority of British people who really didn't benefit and who were being exploited as much as, really almost as much as the Canadians or, you know, the Americans at different times. That's something to keep in mind.
I had a question regarding, at the time the British signed a law to give Canada its independence, kind of just like giving it to them before they actually had to fight for it.
Yeah.
I think it was part of a bigger movement to have less responsibility towards its colonies, less financial responsibilities, and more like just let them just basically to keep the market. That's what they wanted to keep, right?
Yeah, well, this is a thing, and I mean, you had something that I didn't really go into was that there's a fellow named John McLean who basically organized, people familiar with the national policy a little bit that we had, 1879 to 1912 or 13, it's about 33 years of a protectionist policy in Canada modeled upon the tariff of 1858, but also the American system, what had been implemented. You gotta remember this time period, right, when all kinds of, the American system was being adopted worldwide, right, that you have the same policy adopted in Canada. But he said, he said something about that, about what happened around, let's see if I can find it here. Well, basically, the problem was that Canada, in order to get Confederation, had to make certain concessions, and a lot of it was regarding free trade being adopted again, like the takedown of the tariff system that Buchanan had created, right, and basically ensuring that the oligarchy, right, that the financial interests which Britain had in Canada would be preserved, right, and that they wouldn't be compromised, and that if the nation was to be created, right, and Brown was a part of this whole orchestration, that they would be preserved, right, that the British could continue what they were most concerned about, which was profiteering, right? And there's an interesting event in 65 when this delegation of Canadians went over, like John A. Macdonald, Cartier, like the leading Canadians in the Confederation movement.
Did they call them the founders?
Yeah, I guess the founding the fathers of Confederation.
Yeah, that's right.
They basically, at a certain point, were meeting frequently with the fellow who later became Edward VII, and they had a very cozy dinner one night for 2000 at Buckingham Palace, and later were brought into what was called the Inner Circle of 100, right? And they spent time basically, from what Brown's biographer says and the implications of that. I mean, they were smoking opium and things like this with the British royalty, and the inner circle of the British oligarchy. You're talking the inner circle of 100 that are attached to the guy who later becomes the King of England. You're talking about the inner, the hardcore of the British oligarchy at the time. So these guys, you can imagine these three or four, you know, country bumpkin Canadians coming to the heart of the British Empire, right? And like the amount of power concentrated amongst those 100 people, I mean, they're in no position to, you know, the British make them an offer they can't refuse, right? So that was the condition. I mean, so there were conditionalities attached to Canada becoming a nation, and that's really what it had to do with, right? And one thing to keep in mind too is like with this, under the national policy, which MacDonald was one of these guys that got basically twisted, there's an incredible amount of corruption associated with the creation of our transcontinental railway. And a lot of that has to do with like these Lord Strathcona types, right? These oligarchs who basically got all the contracts, right? These British guys who were basically there to just loot the colony, and that happened a lot over the years. But yeah, I mean in terms of Confederation, it was not the British were not like doing us a favor, right? It was completely in their own interest, right, to do that.
Like even to this day, Bruce reminded us yesterday that the Constitution of Canada or the
British North America Act.
Yeah, it starts off by saying this is a law of Canada was made a country by a law of the British government.
Yeah.
So there's no separation. Mm-hmm. It's an extension still to this day.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. People read the
at that time, can you speak about independent country?
Can we speak about it?
Yes.
Okay.
This particular one?
Well, yeah, the United States a long time before. Haiti, Mexico, France. So it was like a long time after like the big push, I guess, for nation state.
But the thing is when you have a country that's made comfortable, and it's like somebody is living at his parents' house and and the parents are paying for everything.
Difficult to speak, but independent.
Are you asking like how we could create an independent country here, or
no? Actually, think that it is a particular situation with Canada.
Is it implying the myth or the appearance?
Is it familiar for you?
Oui, par français.
Mais je voulais demander en français.
Non, c'est juste une remarque. Je voulais demander de dire le Canada indépendant. Pour moi, quand je suis arrivé ici, la façon dont c'est géré, c'est comme si les Anglais, là, il y a encore quelque chose.
When you arrived here, for the impression you got that you felt like a British aura.
Because when you consider the Canada to go to war, it is the governor who decides.
Mm-hmm.
But and now the governor is the one designated by the British administration. That means sovereignty. You can think about this course.
Well, Canadians are kind of in denial about their sovereignty. Like they kind of think, oh, the Queen, she's just a figurehead. She's on your money. Yeah, but Governor General. I think the real problem comes back to this. I mean, maybe they leave us alone for the majority of the time, but when has Canada ever challenged the rule of this kind of financier elite in Canada? When have we ever really made proposals that that would seriously contravene their personal interests? We really haven't.
But the Queen doesn't have any political power on it.
No, you got to think in terms of informal power. But again, the queen just, she's serving these financier interests that the whole circle is around.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, last night Bruce talked about this thing, the question of the institution of the presidency is like much larger than the president himself or his immediate advisors, right? It consists of a whole range and assortment of people and institutions and things like this, and you get the same, I think the same way, we need to look at the British monarchy in kind of the same way. Like that example of, you've got the future King Edward VII who organized World War I, you know, and his circle, his inner circle of 100, as he called it, you know, where he does not act independently of these others, and they're all acting together in a sense to maintain power. So it's more like influence, right, like networking and stuff like this, that if this oligarchy has a certain intention for Canada, how do they carry that out? Will they carry that out through...
But they don't need the Queen. I mean, now with free trade, we've got no control over money, and they can threaten us on like interest rates and stuff like that.
Well, what does the Queen have to do? Everywhere you see Queen Elizabeth, everywhere.
What? You have to see it as a progression, because you start by being a colony. So of course, the Queen needs to send an envoy, which has the Governor General in France, who was an aide, so you start like that, you have these representatives of the Queen that are there. And at a certain point, when you look at the development in the United States, then you have this push from the population, you got Americans asking Canadians, can you join? You have this debate over what's the real... a real nation, how do you become sovereign and adopt a proper system? But then you have the British, who are the oligarchy, who in defense will say, okay, well, they look kind of mad, okay, you can speak French, you can be Catholic. So you start by giving out some candies to calm down the population. But the more it goes, the more you see, like, you get in a position where you're at in the 1840s, where you have this shitty government, not responsible government, but you know, you got people you elected for, kind of looks like a government, you know, but the Governor General decides everything. Mm. And then you get this other system where you have, in 1867, we have a Senate, get a House of Commons, and you get all these powers divided, but still the main people taking the main decisions. It's still starting from Great Britain, because they were holding still the foreign policy and other things. And as you were saying, you know, you can discuss about gay weddings, go ahead, do whatever, or different little issues like that. Then at a certain point, yes, because you have in the own government, like prime ministers, and they say, well, look, the Governor General doesn't have, shouldn't even listen to that person. I think he had Bennett. There was a debate in 1910, on that, right? But still, you don't just do that like that. Knowing the United States has to fight a war, right? You still have this oligarchy who's, it's like a check and balance for the oligarchy. If something happens, you don't have the Queen saying, "I refuse the Canada for do such and such." Right? It doesn't work like that. But it's gonna go through scandals or through financial operations, right? It's like an operation in the population being done by these oligarchical networks. But still, you get this Governor General and this parliamentary system, which is not really efficient, where you still have this idea of if your representative is the opinion, and the one who's going to sign the laws is still the Governor General. So you're still in a situation where if the ones that created the situation where you could ask for more, if these guys start going down, if the United States or other nations start losing their own sovereignty at the hands of the oligarchy, people like Rohatyn or some other things, then you're in a situation where your own situation is going to be a lot more dangerous because of that system. But you got to see these people as being active. You can't just see, well, she's sitting on the throne and playing ping pong. She's doing something.
So how is she active here?
She doesn't pass any laws. She doesn't block any laws.
No, she barely comes here.
Huh?
She barely comes here. But you have all these people in the private council and these financial institutions that respond to this whole club of the Isle.
So the oligarchy is the power. It's not like we. That's the state, no?
Yeah.
Well, you can see it like that, but I mean, the thing is like her husband.
So queen or no, like it wouldn't change the power of the oligarchy on us.
No, but it's aristocrats. The financial elite are the major families ruling England, including the queen, the prince of our parliament, and the aristocracy.
Yeah.
Queen Elizabeth don't decide or the policy directly that Hallmark would decide or whatever. But I think look at what this is the question I asked to Jack Clayton one time. Barbados, who was like 2 years ago part of the British Commonwealth, the same status as Canada, decided to leave the Commonwealth and say we declare ourselves a republic. And the reason they did for this is that officially, like in Canada, the owner of the natural resources, the head of the state, the major investors in their banks are, I mean, Rothschild, the British, the queen, the British oligarch. I mean, it is not an hasard when the Pierre Trudeau did the rapatriement de la Constitution in the 17th. We did that to be able to change our own constitution by our own and not pass through the British Parliament. But the only thing, that there's a clause in it, that the only thing we cannot change is the status of the Queen as the head of Canada. I mean, it's not just, they don't do it for nothing, there's a reason for it.
But, yeah.
But there's also much more like ugly implication. If you look at, people think that Canada is a clean, we have clean hands and we have a, it's not true. Look at the genocide going on in Eastern Congo, for example, or in Africa, and what we used to be the sphere of influence is the British in the south of Africa. You see the companies that are exploit the population there, are all either British, Canadian, South African, Australian companies of the British Commonwealth. So through our adherence to this British Commonwealth, we continue the legacy of the British Empire in that region of the world, looting their natural resources.
So you're saying that if we were to have a republic, we could break the bond between like our oligarchy and the British oligarchy?
Well, we don't it's not a fatality that you don't need an oligarchy.
No, but the fact that we have one right now.
Yeah, but I mean, look, who is this oligarch serving? Kind of like Wall Street we were discussing earlier.
Their own interest.
It is you. Yeah. I mean, if you're to build a republic, get rid of all oligarchies, and just the British to put the American on the game.
What is when Governor Mikhail Jean designated that last time there was a debate. There are many Canadians say that is not things wrong enough, make nonsense, should banish that one. But actually tell me what's your point of view. Are you against or for that institution?
The Governor General? Mm. So I'm for a republic. So I guess probably I would be against having the Governor General. Like what we're proposing, right, is to create a republic based upon the model of the United States. Right, so I mean, yeah, to us the idea that we're run by these British relics and so on is an odious idea that is better tossed into the gutter. So yeah, I mean, yeah, you don't mean in terms of like a particular person for Governor General, right, but the institution itself?
No, the institution,
yeah.
Not the person.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, I mean, that's the, yeah, I mean, the intention of this movement is to create a republic and to help bring that republic about in this country, right, because again, it goes back to this question of, like, what LaRouche is trying to do right now, his proposal to basically nationalized the Federal Reserve System to take it into bankruptcy reorganization. Right, that and this question of the oligarchy and how you, in a sense, outflank the Canadian oligarchy, if we were to break with this British tradition, right, then you've got to take away their power base, which is in controlling the financial system, controlling the monetary system.
Can we do that without breaking from the Queen?
Well,
you see, the thing is, it's like, Canada's history evolved. Like, we're not, in a sense, we have industries, right, there's a few things that were done before. So, and just like other nations, right, you have kingdoms still, mm-hmm. and you have pretty well-developed kingdoms, right? So like in the Arab Emirates, you have science there. I mean, they're not just exporting their sand or something. the oil, also, which helps. but if you have a development towards, say, the general welfare, mm-hmm. you have these type of systems that have to make concessions. They have to okay, for, right? If you have a vote in the House of Commons, like, I don't know, like, 60% of the people vote for a national bank or like a new deal in Canada, and you have a popular support. That's important. You need a popular support. You need the people to understand these ideas as well, so that they don't get brainwashed and they don't get afraid by some tanks or trucks full of gold, like leaving the banks and stealing from the banks. And, so then yes, you have, despite your lousy system, if you have a reasonable population, you can do many things, because, you know, don't just say we're going to be a republic and then we're going to be start, it's like the Etat Québécois, let's separate and then we're going to talk about economics. Well, how about we start, and we can do something without being separated. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing, you want to act now, on the basis of reason, despite the problems that you have.
You're still going, yeah.
Wow, I think you could still get it. Because the root answer to that one is that you don't need to, you don't need to skin the cat if you want to have like a real economic development in Canada. You don't need like to have a armed revolution or something. Just with a good partnership with the United States and Mexico and people in Europe, you can have the winning conditions where at a certain point, the idea of a republic is in the people's mind. People say, maybe we should be a republic. And now they're just asking, well, what's the difference?
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should emphasize also the cultural and psychological necessity for Canada to make that like clear break from its history up to now with the British Empire. There's a comment that Leibniz made in his writings on China, where he comments on the description of the Chinese society by different authors, like Loretta or whatever. And they describe it as this, you know, peaceful, quiet, cool society. Everybody lives in peace. There's everybody doing its own little business. Kind of like the image you have of Canada. And Leibniz says, these people, yes, they live in peace, but that kind of society doesn't produce renaissance. It is not fit for what LaRouche will say is successful survival in the long term. At the moment, you have a quiet and peaceful society, but you need human societies need something more if they want to create a future for a coming generation and increasing human population. So the thing is, how do you create that culture and that psychology with the Canadian population of really leaving aside this little quiet kingdom of the middle, I don't know what, and joining, you know, civilization the way it was done in other parts of the world. So that can, that just helps a lot, but it's, I think, necessary if we're to survive and to win our nation.
You know, you look at the difference maybe in, when people come here or whatnot, you know, this idea of the United States being historically the land of opportunity, things like this, you know, where you you went there in order to create a future. And you went there with a certain intention in participating in something that was an ongoing, like a great experiment, you know, like the greatest experiment that humankind had embarked upon up to that point, you know, say the 19th century after the War of Independence, right? So the idea that even if you just arrived in that land, that you started participating in that. Right? Whereas in so there's an idea that you could come and partake of. But in Canada, I mean, we get lots of people coming here, right, from all over the world, but when they come here, do they have a sense that they have begun to participate in something great, you know, some kind of a national mission, right, that again, unites the nation, and this is part of that British tradition, that, you know, if we can break with that, right, and conceive ourselves as a nation, right, we can actually do something great and break that cultural problem of, you know, do we have the moral fitness to survive?
Mm-hmm. Do you think it will be possible the next 50 years to switch England from the queen and prime minister to a presidential political system?
Could England go to a republic?
Yeah.
I don't know.
They could help with that?
Why? Well, think about it. It's like, if there's a movement where the United States reclaims its independence and lives up to its true constitution, mm-hmm. it's a major change which influences, like, people like Canada are sure to want to follow in going back into the tradition that was the opportunity that had been kind of wasted. So we have a situation where most countries will want to imitate.
Yeah, like if Canada do it, maybe Australia will want to do it, and all the others want to stand that. British people for so many years have been oppressing this poor Canadian. We have to change that forever.
Well, it's just a reaffirmation of what it means to be American, and there's a real understanding in the culture of what that means. You've got a situation where these ideas will not be insular to the States. They will flow all around the world. But, and then people will not be afraid to express these ideals, because it will be a victory will have been made.
Yeah.
So it's very possible, I think, if we win this fight in the States, that's the only way we can have this even British country becoming a republic.
To the brim. To the brim now.
Is it you are?
Not easy.
Well, it's got to come. That's the whole idea, that if the English people, I guess, want to free themselves of that yoke, right? And
I think that they
are set by their
nation.
But it's not a question. I don't think that these people are proud of the situation. It's a question of their. If right now the power is there, but if there's a shift in power, there's no historical benefit to keep with this mentality. There's no. It may be emotional.
Yes,
but the entire identity, or a large part of British, I mean, you look at the way they react on the Queen's birthday or them, it's completely insane. Yeah. Their identity is situated within their monarch,
mm-hmm.
which is, I mean, let's deal with Canada first. It's a bigger problem.
Yeah. You had a question?
What I'm hearing so far, and what you said about the experiment in the U.S. was like nothing before humanity. But what I'm hearing so far that kind of disturbs me is that it's very Eurocentered, and the principles we're bringing up, and the truths or the you know, all that is based on the Renaissance ideas or like our Greek inheritance, and do we have anything else, like any input from other civilizations or other cultures around the world in, for instance, the Larouche movement or the Larouche, like build up in principles and truths and all that, or just things that match, you know, in other cultures that are comparable?
It's not really European-centric, it's just that as this part of the world, they were able to develop their potential at a higher level. But basically the idea, like if you go back to China, like Confucius, the same ideas are there. It was not brought to at the same level. But basically it's not European, it's not American, but it's human.
But even like specific European civilization is the product of not only European, but I mean the Greeks themselves were taught by the Egyptians. Now what were the Egyptians? They were black Africans. And Europe was able to escape the Dark Age that Bruce presented to us later through a rediscovery of the Greeks. Through who? Through the Arabic, for example. I think what we call European civilization,
the Mediterranean.
Yeah, well, it's the center of contribution to different cultures to produce what we call European civilization, but it's not the poverty of Europeans, and it's not the poverty of anybody. I mean, like he said, it's human. Everybody contributed to it. So, I mean, European civilization is incorporating in itself the best of all the other cultures and conquered in its history. I mean, you look at the contribution of the Jewish community in Germany and the modern standards and you got there's many, many examples. So, when you talk about European civilization, you talk about human civilization.
Mm-hmm.